Good evening, friends. Today's speaker is Dr. Ramanna himself, our director. You do understand there's no question of introducing him, as because for many reasons, but one of the main reasons is that he is, in fact, in addition to the speaker, he's our host. So I am not even trying to introduce him, but the subject he will be speaking on, non-proliferation and transfer of technology, is, as you know, a subject which has not only dominated our newspapers for a year or more, it gives rise to heated discussion whenever this topic is raised in practically any forum. And here in NIES too, Dr. Ramanna has been informally discussing this kind of issue with us for quite some months now. And partly as a result of these several informal, slightly fragmented discussions, we thought that it would be a very good idea if Dr. Ramanna were able to crystallize the entire thing together and give us a talk. And hence, today's talk by Dr. Ramanna on non-proliferation and transfer of technology. Please, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, the subject of non-proliferation and technology transfer, or certainly the subject of non-proliferation, is almost 50 years old. And so much has been written about it that it's impossible to keep pace with all that's been said. But there's been a lot of politics, there's been a lot of diplomacy, there's been some high technology and high science. There's also been lots of stupidity. And to bring all this to your attention in the hour, I'll surely be leaving some very important things out. But you must be reading in the past few days the Prime Minister's statements that we will not sign and we'll stand on our own. And under these circumstances, I think, as Dr. Sen mentioned, it's a subject which should be discussed in public and some of the facts made known to those interested. But I make some general remarks in the beginning that in recent times, because of high technology spreading all over, the world has integrated a lot. You cannot deny that. You can send a letter in a few minutes' time by email or fax. You can go to New York if you've got the money in a few hours' time. And that's bound to create a commonness in the world. The speed of integration has gone up very high. But at the same time, we have this problem of nationalism. And nationalism, for those countries like ours, is a very important ingredient in our thinking. Now, nationalism can become ethnic, religious oriented, all that sort of thing. But it is nationalism which has made us survive all these centuries, survive. And we cannot just say nationalism is bad, and you must throw it out. It's just not possible. I cannot imagine a world with everybody thinking alike. Even in this room, we will not think alike. So you will see that social change is taking place in the whole world. But social change has always been associated with revolution, wars, and now terrorism. So we have to take all these things into account when we are discussing non-proliferation. I'm sure because it's a very old subject and so much has been written about it, the old history you know. But I will not talk about how immediately after discovery of fission, particularly that more neutrons are produced than one neutron that is absorbed, it took a very short period of time to build a demonstration reactor, and within 4 or 5 years the nuclear weapon had been perfected to the extent that it could be thrown on a country or on a city and destroyed. Why two were bombed, were used one after the other, I don't know. But for the first one, there has been a lot of defense that it helped the world. But these things I'm not going to discuss. They're part of history. But it is after the development of the first bomb that I would like to bring you up to date with the history. But what we did notice was that it could be done in such a short period of time, because they were afraid that Hitler may produce a bomb. He had the scientists, he had all the laboratories, but he didn't have the vision. And if he had, unfortunately, we don't know what would have happened to the world. But all the scientists got together, many countries got together and produced the bomb in an unbelievably short time. That we have to note. But because so many scientists had to get together to produce this bomb, and with all the the financial power of the United States, at the time of during the Second World War, when this was all developed, the feeling got round that only very powerful, highly technologically developed countries would have anything to do with nuclear weapons, which was perhaps a mistake, to the extent that even sharing nuclear secrets with their own colleagues, the US and the British, broke down immediately after the war stopped. So that Britain started developing on her own, the Americans started carrying on with all the previous information that they had from experience. So right at the very beginning, even as they were saying, oh, America is the only country which can possess a bomb, and we will keep the whole thing secret so that nobody will get hold of the nuclear secrets, and automatically no other country will be able to produce. But such was the politics that even Britain was left out, and so proliferation started. It became two, and naturally France felt the same, and the Soviet Union was at that time wanting to equal the United States all the time. And strangely enough, if I may be permitted to be a little personal, my professor in King's College London in the year 1945-46 was suddenly pounced on by the local police, taken away, and unlike here, in about 3 days' time, over the weekend, he was produced before the judge. And the judge sentenced him to 10 years for passing on nuclear secrets from Los Alamos and those places to the Russians, because he was a very strong communist. You know, in that period, Britain had a very strong group, communist group in Cambridge in the early 30s and 20s and the 30s. And he thought it was the right thing, that there should not be a monopoly of nuclear weapons, and he passed on, I think, a few grams or micrograms, I don't remember the actual quantity, of uranium-235, which was such a secret material with all sorts of pseudo names. So even as the nuclear weapon was born, the idea of a monopoly of one country had disappeared. And yet the United States felt for a long time that if you keep the nuclear secrets with all the rigidity that goes with secrecy, that nuclear weapons would not spread. When they realized that spreading was going to take place, at least among the more advanced countries, and there was a little pressure from their industry saying that nuclear business is not simply weapon business, but it has got many peaceful uses, which I will not go into today. the power is being one, besides production of isotopes and medical uses, agricultural uses, so many possibilities. There was a lot of pressure from their industry to have a system by which they could set up power reactors all over the world and have a control on them. Control in the sense they would get a industrial control and also make sure that any fissile material which could be turned into weapons was under control in some international body. I'm talking of the year of 1953. That was the when the idea came that we should start an international atomic energy agency. There were lots of discussions, but heart of heart, the Western countries believed, yes, they would have their own weapons. There was always the fear of the Soviet Union coming in. And Russia had agreed that there must be an international control whenever they pass on things to other countries, purely for on the basis of peaceful uses, based on commercial deals. Unfortunately, the Cold War developed into something very serious, and it became a tug of war at every stage. However, I recall myself the days when the International Atomic Energy Agency was started in Vienna, and I was told that one of the reasons for putting it in Vienna was Dr. Baba was responsible because he was interested in music and the arts. Vienna was a terrible city at that time. It had suffered badly during the war, but now you just can't imagine what a fine city it's become. But when the international body met in the plenary sessions, naturally everybody said, what is all this security? We are not in a position to make bombs. We are not in a position to produce nuclear material. So what is the use of this international body? Why must we join it? Then they had to compromise and say, all right, the functions of the IAEA will be not simply accounting fissile materials, it will give technical assistance to all countries, however backward they are, in fact more assistance to backward countries, to be able to use nuclear power for their industrial uses. They will do all the problems of information transfer, so that if you want to know how to build a reactor, how to maintain it, all the control systems, the nuclear physics side, they would have all the material in one place and transfer it when required. And as a third one, they said they would account for fissile material, only fissile material that goes to the fuel in the reactor, that when they give them fuel, the fissile material that is produced in this reactor will come under safeguard. That means they'll watch out, keep an account of how much was put in, how much they could produce, how much they actually have. And this was all fairly reasonable as long as it referred to fuel transfers, fuel accounting. I do recall, but I can't find the papers because I don't know, Dr. Iyengar is here, perhaps he's seen the papers, that at that time there was some effort to say if one renounces the use of nuclear weapons, will the Western countries provide an umbrella? That is, come to their assistance if some country tries to throw a bomb or does throw a bomb. And I think no Western country was willing to undertake this responsibility. So that was the situation in the 50s and the 60s. I think this was especially after the war with Pakistan and China, that we said, look, all this thing that you are building up, saying that you should control fissile material, you should have inspectors looking at your various things and accounting, and you say that you will not give any other protection against misuse by other countries. But as time went on, the situation became worse. because more and more countries joined the nuclear club. But when you asked a European, how is it that you have allowed Britain, of course, France, the Soviet Union, of course, and China also to develop all these things? They said, well, the good reason we give you is we are the victors of the Second World War. And so we are justified, we have veto power in the United Nations, so these are the people who are, we will not question. And a little later, when India exploded the Pokhran test, there was some reason at that time, and I think I should make this clear, about the history of the period. The advanced countries were propagating not only nuclear power all over the world, because it was an industrial operation for them, but also saying how nuclear energy and modern technology would produce unlimited power to fusion, which unfortunately has not come about, unless we take the very latest about cold fusion, which I am told is showing some very interesting new developments. Just today I heard through Dr. Iyengar, who is present. And there was a lot of literature, exhibitions of the sort in the early 60s on how nuclear explosions could be used for peaceful purposes. The exhibition was full of them. Plowshare project could dig deep holes in about a few minutes' time, which in this country would have taken 5 years, with women holding baskets on their heads. And you could divert rivers, which was attempted in a way in the Soviet Union to divert the Pechora-Kama rivers into the Caspian Sea, where the density of the water was always increasing because the natural flow into these big seas were cut off by damming and for utilization of agriculture. So the salinity was going up, and to reduce the salinity they wanted to divert rivers into that. And there was a tremendous amount of literature. And by the time we had reached a sufficient technological status, when we could go for a nuclear explosion, specifically for peaceful purposes, but when it was done, nobody believed us, and we'll leave that part for the time being, and we'll come back to it at another stage. But before the IAEA was formed, the International Atomic Energy Agency, what was permitted was a lot of bilateral activity between India and Canada, between America and India, between Russia and India, France and India. In fact, they used to encourage bilateral activity, perhaps for industrial reasons, commercial reasons, as well as perhaps keeping an eye on what was happening. But very soon after the Pokhran explosion, a division had to be done between various countries. Classification. This by the more advanced countries. We have the five countries who had already gone into the weapon business, and the justification was that they won the Second World War. And there was another group of countries which were very technically advanced and could have done the nuclear weapon very easily, and that's all known now, like Germany or Japan, but they were defeated countries. And there was another group of countries which in some literature used to call as the rogue countries. I mentioned these rogue countries because the new attitudes that are developing is we are right, they are wrong. Reminds you of the 30s when we were in the colonial period. But the countries that came across were South Africa. South Africa signed a treaty with the IAEA that they would allow total inspection of their facilities, and yet their Prime Minister, what I forget his name, starting with K, Clark, is it? Yeah. He announced, yes, we had six ready, but now they have been destroyed. Then what were the inspectors doing of the IAEA, which had been specially created for this? Israel, of course, there is information that they tested outside, and it was believed that the circumstance in which the country was founded, a nuclear protection was necessary. I'm not saying who said it, but the general feeling was. At that time, of course, Argentina and Brazil had nuclear ambitions and would not sign the treaty. And of course, we didn't sign the treaty for a very different reason. We said, you're dividing the world between the have-haves and the have-nots, and this is not fair. If all of you sign that your country can be searched, that's one thing. But you choose five or six countries like this and leave the others out, yes, it would be all fine if it was a wonderful world, but some of them are neighbors. Some of them were at that time threatening us. And when we took this attitude, perhaps Pakistan was even encouraged to take another attitude, and they seem to have developed a certain degree of nuclear capability. Well, that is the situation, accentuated as time goes on to the present times. But let's examine what was the proposal that the advanced countries and the IAEA was making to countries connected with safeguards. First of all, as I told you, the IAEA was supposed to look at the fissile material, account for the fissile material which is necessary for making a bomb. But then they found the countries could easily make a bomb for themselves, provided they had a lot of other conventional equipment, like a moderator, pumps. Well, a moderator is not necessarily a conventional piece of equipment, but it's essential for producing fissile material in a reactor. Then we noticed that the safeguards would apply to pumps, heat exchangers, materials of construction, and D2O production, which of course should come under the moderators. And that they would not supply you pumps required for nuclear systems, heat exchangers, unless you sign on the dotted line. And the funniest part was, I was receiving a letter when some hospital wanted NMR equipment, nuclear magnetic resonance equipment, which is used for various medical operations. The letter came saying, this is a nuclear material, we will not supply it to you. Now, that cannot be anything other than the most peaceful humanitarian use. So when big countries decide to have a certain policy, we know very well in this country how it's interpreted by the lesser people. And you found yourself that anything connected with N or A was being stopped. Now, this made it even worse for our situation. As things exist, there's a big embargo on nuclear materials in this country, on this country. This word embargo has been used only in connection with the Iraq, but it has been in existence ever since we stopped, refused to sign the proliferation treaty as it was. Now let me go to a newer look on how we feel about proliferation and how the Americans feel and the Westerners feel about proliferation. I say West and I say USA as almost the same, because since the exit of the Soviet Union, there's a certain degree of synonymity in using these expressions. As I told you, they classified themselves into Western countries, the Eastern countries in Europe, then in rogue countries in inverted commas, because who had the capability and would not sign, and of course the poor countries who did not know what they were signing. Because at some stage, I remember the IAEA, the various Western delegations used to go to all sorts of countries, Zambia, Tanzania, and those little islands in the Pacific, to sign the non-proliferation treaty when they had the least chance of producing. I believe, of course, one day everybody can produce it, but it's a question of time, maybe 200 years from now, 100 years from now. But the fact is that they went round, got them to sign. Now, what was the return for having signed it? I don't know, but they must have thoroughly enjoyed it, but a lot of countries signed it. And then they used to come and say, majority of nations have signed, and why are you making this fuss? This is democracy. When this was pointed out to me that there is a thing called national sovereignty, the situation became tougher and tougher. Now, some of you experts here may know all about this, but I know the general public does not realize the difficulties that the Indian program had to face immediately after Pokhran to become totally self-sufficient. Well, it is at this stage when we talk of the supply of equipment, the question of technology transfer comes, which is the second part of my talk this evening. Now, technology is a thing which will not produce any ideas of humanitarian use, good or bad. Technology simply depends on the laws of science, and you can do it or you can't do it. Whether it's good for you or not is the human mind which has to decide. But strange enough, a great part of modern technology has dual uses. Nuclear energy is a typical example of something which can be used for producing power and has been produced. For instance, in France, 75% of all its power is nuclear. Belgium, a small country, but France is more comparable. And in America itself, 25% or something like that is nuclear, in a country which produces so much enormous amount of power. China is very much less because they came into the peaceful use of atomic energy much later than us. And I think their first reactor just went recently, I forget the exact dates. Now, when you have dual uses, how can you control what goes from which country? The moment you have control, you have black market. That comes automatically. And I think the governments have only realized recently, in the name of liberalization, that you make ineffective controls, it makes things much worse. Now, when I say ineffective controls, we know how difficult it is to assess the amount of plutonium produced in a reactor, where it is stored, how the one man or one or two people who come from some foreign place will find out how much there is. In a large country like India, leave alone Baghdad, they have problems according to what the newspaper says. Though I'm not so sure that all that the newspaper says is right, that's a different issue. But the difficulties of assessing is a problem we have to face sometime. In fact, I'll end my lecture on that one. But the difficulties of saying that, no, you should not do this, when it's clear to you that there is a dual use. In this particular case of nuclear, there's a dual use for weapons as well as power. And there are many others. The very fact that you have developed a new technology always has a certain defense application. If suppose transistors were developed and say it's very good for electronics, you mean to say it's not good for communicating between tanks and planes and things like that? Every bit of technology has a dual use. It is the sensitivity of the nation's concern who should know what is used for peaceful purposes, for the improvement of the economy of the country, and for general improvement as a whole. Now, I am one of those who believe that if you don't keep pace with technology and you have a certain degree of confidence in your own technology, you will always be at the low level. However rich you are, and I'm going to make an example, like the Middle East, they have all the money in the world, they buy a lot of equipment, defense equipment, but when the actual stress comes, I don't think they can service to that extent. As you remember, even that missile that was used during the Baghdad war, in connection with, they were sending some to Israel, and they were not going anywhere properly, because they had no method of improving their technology. They were much better off generally than many other countries. But I'm giving this to you only as an example that you can go on buying equipment, but that doesn't give you the strength which you would get if you knew how to improve on them, how to develop on them. I was rather surprised that the MBT tank, which has now come for actual use by the army, was criticized by some people in various articles. Having known its capabilities, yes, of course, if the engine we were not quite capable of, well, we can improve at least that part of the engine. But the rest is a very complex system. The materials that goes to make a tank to protect it, the electronics that goes to get the right signals, and aligning the gun in the right direction in spite of bad terrain is a thing which people don't appreciate. And you find long articles written by various people. But I think, in my own view, the very fact that certain things have been developed in this way gives us more confidence, more strength. I mentioned these things because I remember the Atomic Energy at one time started making medical electronics. But for some reason, it was not given sufficient support to make it into a great industry. And now you find most of the sophisticated medical electronics being imported from outside, and the maintenance problems being frightful. There is a little effort now again, but more on an imitative basis, to produce the necessary medical electronics. But we lost a great chance in being an important electronic country and a medical electronic country by not rising to the occasion. However, I must say that in the field of materials, and I think it's essentially due to atomic energy, where the Atomic Energy Department had to develop strange elements for its work, which had not been heard of at all by the general public, like zirconium, alloys of zirconium, beryllium, uranium itself. And I think, I recall the first comment of the Canadians when we said we are making our own uranium fuel for the Cyrus reactor, the first reactor. They stated, well, let us remind you that making uranium fuel for this type of reactor is very difficult. You have gone through many problems. So all right, you go ahead and produce the reactor, but when you are in trouble, you come to us, when you are really badly off. And a group under Dr. Brahm Prakash, whose lecture in his name, in my memory, is being delivered by Dr. Iyengar tomorrow, he said, we'll take the challenge, and produced fuel better than what the Canadians were doing. I say better because they wrote back to say, your fuel is much better than us, and the letter exists. And of course, after that, they began to realize that India could be a technological great country in no time. But once that was solved, there was the zirconium problem, which my friend Sundaram was fully involved in, and several other rare materials of various types were exploited. Now, the new elements like photonics and all that are coming. Have we lost initiative on that because of the new idea that everything can be bought from outside? Anyway, worries. But what is important to notice is, while this country or any country can survive any kind of influence from outside, if there's a bilateral agreement, we know where to go, where to stop. But when a few countries get together to form a little vested group, then it makes things very difficult for us. And this is what exactly what the London Club and all these, the Western countries did, and called themselves first Euratom. Now, Euratom is a very interesting, when the IAEA was formed, and they asked for permission to supervise the development of reactors and the uses for diversion. They say, oh, IAEA consists of all sorts of countries. We in Europe will have our own. And the Euratom was formed. And one of the functions of Euratom was only to supervise the European countries. And I recall at the meeting Baba saying, if a few countries in Asia get together and said, we will supervise our own, will you agree? Well, of course, they said, well, the time has not come for it, on some escape clause. So constantly over the years, countries have been getting together, and I believe these are like the old coffee and tea cartels of the past, so that they control the whole system. And this situation still continues. I will now move to the present situation. What are we going to do? The situation as it exists is there are countries with lots of weapons, and the Cold War was responsible for the development of weapons of all types, most, and then they were going into Star Wars so that even the space could be used for destroying countries here. But whether you like it or not, the Soviet Union collapsed. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Cold War stopped. And even before the Cold War stopped, I think Gorbachev had come to some agreement that instead of having thousands of nuclear weapons, we'll reduce it to a smaller number. But even the number that they have decided on, 3,000 or 4,000 nuclear weapons, is very large, enough to destroy the whole world. But from 8,000 or something, they have come to 3,000. And said, this is the amount that we'll keep to reflect our power. They don't say these words, but I'm interpreting it. You may not agree with me. And this place is it. These meetings are free for you to ask any questions when the time comes. Now there is a tremendous pressure on India, as we see from literature, that we should sign, and we are really responsible by holding back. And as people used to tell me, why are you not signing it? What's wrong with that? Well, we have neighbors who have been hostile, who are still hostile, and who are threatening. Sometimes somebody says, oh yes, we have nuclear weapons, whether they have it or not, that's a matter to, is difficult to verify. And then, how does one look at own independence? After all, in my own lifetime, we saw this as a colonial country, where we were never asked for any big decisions. In the Second World War, we were declared war on Germany, and nobody was asked here. We did many other things for which India was never consulted as such, because we had the foreigner ruler who used to say, Mr. Lord Linlithgow used to say yes, and that was good enough. I think it was the Viceroy at that time said, okay, we are in a war. And that's why I think the Quit India movement, which we celebrated recently, I don't know what the celebration meant, but there it was started. I was rather surprised. Close down of all work was declared on that day, when the only thing way to celebrate it was to increase twice the production on that particular day of any type of work that you were doing. But be that as it may, I don't want to sound unnationalistic and say I'm glad we celebrated that great event which has brought us to this state. But we understand what a colonial rule is, and we do know how decisions are forced on us, which is not necessarily good for us in any way. So when these forces act on us, we have to stand firm on certain issues. And one of them is freedom of development in our industry and freedom of what is good for us on our defense. But if there is an agreement all over the world that we will stop proliferating on certain types of development, which is good for the peace of the world. The world has become so small, as I told you in the beginning, that we must have a certain morality. And whether we've used Mahatma Gandhi's morality correctly or not recently, there has been much humbug. But we still, at our levels here, in the Institute of Advanced Study, must face this fact that we have to propagate certain things. And one of them is, you must renounce certain things. But if you say, you renounce, we will do what we want, that's another form of colonialism. There's nothing else. Because if it was simply saying, all right, we are very responsible people, five countries, very technologically advanced, we will never hurt anybody, except in under very bad circumstances or strange circumstances. But we can't trust you, because you are poor, you have been a colonial, and you may misuse the power that you have. But we are all right. But that is itself, again, a colonialism. It's, as I call it, old wine in new bottles. But to make the situation sound a little more cheerful, I happened to be in the United States only recently, and had a long talk with, I won't mention the name there, because I see some press people here, a very distinguished person there, who was bringing to my attention that when he had anything to do with nuclear business, he used to get so much information about other countries on which he had to act. And all the information that he was getting from there, or the more important types, after 20 years, he found were false. And he said, look, I had been through a situation when I could have destroyed the world on wrong information. And therefore, he said, that the Western countries, or USA, should give up nuclear weapons completely. And at the moment, a little later, I met some professors in the university. Well, how shall we solve the nuclear problem? You are the people who are so holding all this, holding out against all this. But one thing, US will not give up weapons. So you see their dilemma. They have become powerful. They have, to a certain extent, a feeling that they are the policemen of the world. It's very good if the United Nations take over as policemen. But there must be real policemen who get hold of criminals. But who is a criminal, who is not a criminal, will become a matter of big interpretation in the years to come. Be that as it may,
The very fact that nuclear weapons can be directed against things under false information, wrong information, under terrorist conditions, means, as this great gentleman said, must be wiped out. Now, India has been saying this for a long time, but circumstances near us have forced us to this situation. And it is even said that if the United States says, all right, we are over a period of years, we'll gradually renounce, it's quite likely Europe will follow, it's quite likely China will follow. We hope this is a possibility. You may say the world is still cynical, but there have been cases where I think chemical warfare is coming under some control. Bacterial warfare we are best at, of course, because we have a lot of bacteria in this country. But that's not God made.
We didn't make it.
So there are situations coming when the people are getting disgusted with these weapons of mass destruction. But whether the forces that be rise to this high occasion, there are Mahatma Gandhis even now and all over the world, I do not know. But my own suggestion is that if there is a world movement to completely disarm in every country and ban weapons, we should take up a special position to see that the way is created for such a situation. We've been saying this all the time. But to say, look, without, you will not come to your protection. But at the same time, you cannot compete with us economically. We will not pass on technology to you because it is dangerous for your economics. Then we have to take a different view. There's not a humanitarian worldview there. It's business of who makes more money and who remains poor all the time. That situation is still possible with the present control on the transfer of technology. We in India have seen it from our atomic energy, how it was forced on us, but fortunately this country rose to the occasion. There were many industries who did things for us. And I do recall how when they were accusing, they were using the Cyrus plutonium for the Pokhran explosion, we decided to build another reactor called the Dhruva reactor. And the Dhruva reactor was designed here, and every part for it was made here, and it's working continuously all from the time it became critical. Yet, I will say, to the sadness of my compatriots, that in the papers they criticized it, saying that this will never work. This is bad, this is a big humbug, all sorts of things. Oh, the terrible things that were written. I could even tell you which journal it came. But the poor man who used to write it is dead. And not a word now that how steadily the thing has worked. I've given you a little bird's eye view of what happened in the last 50 years or 45 years. And I was connected closely for some time. But the more recent events, naturally we, like all of you, read the newspapers or some special journals. And I don't know that the Indian government can take a very sudden new view of these things. There are situations growing in which a little isolation may take place to this country. But it's for us to decide whether we'll face the isolation and conquer it, or say, well, we'll go back to a new colonial form. I think that's a terrible thing to say for a person who has lived in the colonial era. But the language used is very strange. When you read that article in the Hindu by a man called some Rice, I forget his name. He's some Woodrow Wilson scholar or something. Maybe he's a very young man, I don't know, I've not seen him. And he says, India should be warned that when they confront with the USA, they're standing before the sun. In the old days, they used to say the sun never sets on the British Empire. the language is similar. Then he goes on to say in a very strange way, the word he uses, India should sign the NPT. She can do what she wants afterwards. That means it will be like Baghdad, having signed the NPT does something, and then you have all the various troops from various parts of the world coming. Now we should see that that kind of thing doesn't happen, but this is a statement made in the press. I'm probably giving too much importance to somebody who should not give so much importance, but it was in the middle page of the Hindu. And not only that, the many Indians who came to me and said, have you read this wonderful article? It tells you a sign, without really realizing the consequences. And of course, in recent times, and the last paragraph of his second article is also very interesting. It says, look, India must do something to get on with the rest of the world. I know they're all very angry about the cryogenic engine. But they have to face the fact that they cannot get the cryogenic engine from outside. And if they try to make things on their own, they may find themselves in very awkward positions. It sounded like Lord Linlithgow saying, look, you better do this or you'll find yourself in great difficulty. The Lord has gone now. That's all. Now, gentlemen, this is all I have to say. I probably said nothing very new, but I have said it the way I wanted to. Thank you very much. Now,
sir, one must take into account the fact that technology has advanced so much rapidly. Take for fields like communications, computers and so on. Despite the fact that, of course, Americans or American industry would like to have total control of them, it is no longer possible for them. Do you see in other areas also such things, happening? And is there something that you can take in regard to kind of this missile treaty and nuclear treaty, a position that is neither American nor Indian, but something in between, a give and take, which would sort of bring about the kind of a better situation in future? Okay.
Well, that's why I quoted Mr. McNamara, whose name I'll suggest, because the question hour is informal and not to be quoted. Because Mr. McNamara is a very distinguished man. And he's the one who said about the Cuban crisis, all these problems used to come. Now, when he and many of his colleagues say that the final answer anyway to a nuclear question is that we must outlaw nuclear. Generally, it may take many years, that's the right direction. And we can only say which direction we would like to go, because they are very difficult or actual problems. Because if you have a situation that these things are outlawed, who is going to determine that somebody else is not quietly working on it? These problems have to face. Now, these are the technological problems of the future. It's a policing problems. And it must be done that there are very severe penalties after signing. But now they are putting severe penalties not properly implemented on countries which have not signed. Now this is the most illegal situation. You are saying you have to go halfway. Yes, there have been many compromises already. And I think this country will certainly, if all countries agree to do this, go the full way even, not even halfway. But halfway in such matters is very difficult. Because now with terrorism around, a nuclear weapon can be transported from one town to another without anybody knowing it in a truck. If you have the capability, you can do that. What is it? After all, when you move many things from Bombay to Pokhran, it was taken by a truck.
Of course, the countries who were the victors in the Second World War have a club of their own. But three countries which were defeated, Germany, Japan, Italy, I think all of them are more capable, I mean absolutely capable of manufacturing nuclear weapons. Maybe they might have done, I don't know. But they have signed nuclear NPT, and they have not been making any attempts to get out, wriggle out of the earlier commitments that they have entered into, that they will not manufacture these armaments. How can we explain this? I mean, India is a very less developed country compared to Japan, Germany and Italy, but we are pleading that there must be a universal rejection of all these nuclear things, which is very sound ethically. My second question would be about...
Shouldn't we not answer the questions one by one, because I'll forget the first one.
Okay, sir.
Please stay there. The question to the answer is, they were the defeated countries, and they were under the penalty of not even having power reactors in their country till about 1955, I think. They began to relax when the IAEA came in. Before that, there was no nuclear development until that time. And further, in Japan, they were so annoyed with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki that they hated the very idea of war and even an army. They did not even possess a well-equipped army, at least openly, till very recent times. And more recently, when now in a few years' time, I don't know what exact time, the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is going to be revised. And there are many countries saying there's no need for revision, we just ask them to sign again. Japan is saying, I don't think you will sign that treaty again, because at the time when they were all made to sign, they were still defeated countries. Now they're not all that defeated.
Yes, sir, you have answered the second part of the question. Of course, I am an absolute layman and I might be asking a very silly question about the transfer of technology. Well, the one way of doing is do everything yourself, be self-sufficient, be isolationist. Well, I don't think that you really advocated that. The other thing is, well, you must be self-reliant, borrow from anybody, but see that you don't get stuck there and you continuously import technology. You develop on that, as the Japanese did, to make up for the lost time. I thought this was your intention. I don't know. I would like you to...
Well, I'm quite clear on this matter. You can't simply go on importing, nor can you say I'll buy every nut, screw, everything which is cheaply available nearby and from outside, make it here and put up your costs when you only want a few of them. To put up a big factory is the wrong thing to do. But I think if you find your technology at comparable levels, say United States here is here, you are here, they'll treat you like dirt. But if they're somewhere here, they'll say, let's exchange. And that is the situation I'd like to see. That if you are in a stage of technology which is comparable, not necessarily the same level, there is a natural operation which tries to equalize this, or mutually beneficial economically, technologically, that I concentrate on something, somebody else does something, and we get together. I think that is the ideal situation we should work for. And I think that you can't deny that it's a wrong situation. Yes, sir. You're talking of economics on a scale which operates on paper but does not work in practice. First of all, I think probably Satish Chandra can answer these questions better, but I know that people have been consuming electricity from our power stations in various states. And if I know vaguely that they owe us something like 300 crores, of course it's small compared to 6,000 crores and all that, but 300 crores, they won't pay. And the center does nothing to make them pay. It becomes a political affair. So if you start a factory and you earn money, and that man who is supposed to give money doesn't give it to the extent of such large sums of money, economics doesn't work. Economics works when everything is efficiently transferred, quickly done. The one thing. Another thing is we can't make everything ourselves. There are other factories here who make things for us. Some have done excellent jobs. I mentioned them in public, but I don't want to give unnecessary publicity here. But there are big factories who have got into the habit of importing things and not keeping the standards, and it is in the conventional side we have more trouble in maintenance than any other. In fact, you take the Narora, if I am right, I mean, I hope I will be corrected, it's essentially an electrical engineering failure of the turbines and the materials of construction of the rotors or wheels and things like that. It's got nothing to do with nuclear. And the strength of a nuclear power industry depends on how good the general industry is. And they are shaken up like that by various political forces and told, your public sector, we will not treat you this way, that way. Then the demoralization continues everywhere. So when you apply economics to such situations, and I believe economics is a social science and it is not an exact science, it's wrong to call it exact science, then we will have a very different economics chart. That is the one that we have to look at more carefully. Then merely say, all right, this costs so much, this one, he should have produced so much, he doesn't produce. Why? And has not. This has been the problem with respect to the atomic energy situation in the economic. I haven't answered your question fully, but I've given you a hint of it.
Yes. Sir, you are addressing basically the hold that they want to have, treating the nuclear thing as a weapon of mass destruction and use it as kind of a logic to say that why others shouldn't have it, kind of thing. But is it a part of a much larger kind of an economic control of the world, because it is being extended to other areas also? For example, on the missile area, where they started with trying to put a ban on missiles with longer ranges, they are now cutting it down to where they are purely air defense missiles, which by no stretch of imagination are mass destruction weapons. They are also now they are trying to bring in similar kind of controls. Is it also a part of a similar design to get a grip on the whole economy rather than this higher talk of mass destruction and things like that?
I think, sir, your question is answered yourself.